area.
This is continuing the interview with Plato Malazimo from May 4th, 1988. So, you were told later that Fred Searles even considered firing you.
That's right. Well, before all this happened, while I was still a staff member of Newmont, the only staff actually that Newmont had for a time, and because Fred Searles was not sympathetic to Phil Kraft and his judgments, he asked me to get involved with Newmont Oil, and I stood as sort of a buffer between Phil Kraft and Fred Searles at that time, and I learned to respect Phil's knowledge of geology and liked him very much as a person also, so we had a very warm relationship. One of the reasons, and it's a superficial reason, that Fred Searles didn't have much respect for the Newmont Oil the way Philip Kraft ran it was the fact that Philip in recruiting the people to manage the affairs of Newmont Oil Company had girls take care of all the clerical requirements and duties, and hired a girl geologist by the name of Alice Langlois, L-A-N-G-L-O-I-S, quite a pretty French-Canadian geologist, whom he promoted, and she ended up she was finally the vice president of the oil company, and Franz Schneider, as well as Fred Searles, used to refer to Philip Kraft and his organization as Philip's harem, which was not absolutely true, because the treasurer was always a man. When I became president in 1954, I finally assumed presidency of the Newmont Oil Company and was a president from 55 to 62, and after that became chairman of the oil company until I turned that responsibility over to Jackie Thompson, which was much later than that. And Philip and I, in effect, determined the essential policies of the Newmont Oil Company and the various new ventures that we had were always discussed in great detail, both with the geology and possible promise and so on, with me in detail, so that I knew all the aspects that caused Philip Kraft to feel that this was an attractive venture for Newmont to have. I'm not sure that I I did cover the acquisition of the Algerian oil field, the Ruhr del Bagel, development of that. Yes, I did.
North Africa?
Yes, North. Yes, I think that I covered that, I remember that. But I don't think that I covered what I've just said.
No,
in that.
That you did not.
Yes, I did have I remember that, so
you
I think I'll just...
Something on the Continental Oil. Delaware. No, what you just said was not there. Oh, well, that's the one that she just gave you. No, you did not have this before.
Yeah, I think I am pretty sure you have it. During this joint stewardship of Newmont Oil Company and interest, our interest was aroused by a recent discovery in Algeria, and it was Phil Kraft's advice to me and his conviction that for a company, oil company, as small as Newmont, we should follow discoveries rather than try to make new discoveries in a new area, because that takes more money and also involves more risk, and therefore you could reduce the risk and reduce the amount of money you would invest in an area already known to be petroliferous. This was the theory that behind his judgment to await a discovery in Algeria, and when it was made, then he felt that Newmont should get into it, and we did, as I related later on, successfully in finding a major oil field. Unfortunately, it was nationalized later on. A much later development in Newmont was, first of all, before I go to that, I should mention that the an old acquaintance of mine that I was introduced to back in the 1940s, actually, when he was still a mining man, by name of Robert S. Mehlman, M-O-E-H-L-M-A-N, came to my attention as when we were looking for having someone head up the oil company. Shortly after the previous operating head, Oscar Champion, died, I located Mehlman in Houston at a time when he had switched from mining to oil, and having formed a good opinion of him and checked on his record in the oil industry, I was convinced that he would be a good man for us, for Newmont Oil, and we hired him as president in 1962. Philip Kraft was chairman from 1955 to 1968 when he died. And Mehlman remained as president. And as I said before, I was chairman until I gave that up in favor of Jack Thompson. And incidentally, I gave up my post as Jack Thompson for probably the same reason that Fred Searles turned over the responsibility of Newmont Oil to me. I became impatient with the long-windedness of Mehlman and Philip Kraft. Because they would go on forever on even the small small things in the oil company. I just didn't have the time or patience for it. So I turned it over to Jack.
And Jack Thompson was your successor.
Yes. Another very, very significant, probably milestone in Newmont Oil development was an acquisition of interest in the Dutch North Sea in 1986. This is very late. And the interest was owned by a company by name of Aminoil, A-M-I-N-O-I-L, petroleum company, which was a wholly owned subsidiary of Phillips Petroleum International Corporation. Phillips, after an assault on by a raider,
shall we just not even mention his name? Or shall we?
incurred very large debts, and they went into a period of sale of assets in order to reduce these debts, and this is how they decided to sell Aminoil. This was
Subsequent experience with that same individual.
Not the same one.
Wasn't it the same?
No.
Oh, I thought it was. Pickens tried to rape Phillips.
Maybe it was.
Yeah.
I'll have to look that up. Yes, I think it was.
Boone Pickens.
Right. That's right. Well, at any rate, this company only had about 3.5% to 14% in various blocks, and there were a number of blocks. So it's definitely a minority interest. The major interest being held by Exxon and other larger companies. But we made an exhaustive examination of this, headed up by Ed Barton, B-A-R-T-O-N, who succeeded Mailman as president and chief executive of Newmont Oil Company. And he came away from examination with enthusiastic endorsement for purchase of that interest. Question at that time was what to pay for it, and he made various calculations, some more conservative than others, and one of his conservative valuations was $114 million for this, but it was obvious to me that that the major participants in this venture, like Exxon, would buy this interest probably at a higher price. So there was not much point in our offering to buy it at $114 million. We'd never get it. So as a result of a further restudy of the value of this ensued, I was involved in it in some detail, and I reached the conclusion that we might have to bid as much as $180 million for this, otherwise the sale would be preempted by the major partners. At that time, I was grooming Gordon Parker to succeed me, and I was still the chief executive officer, however, so I got him involved in this discussion. He was against our bidding any such a high sum, and he said, well, we should bid no more than $120 million. And I said, well, we'll lose it in that event. And I overruled him, and we finally compromised at the figure of $165 million, which indeed was a successful bid. And a successful bid essentially because we avoided the procedure of of the auction, which was contemplated by Phillips as the way to sell the company. We found, by my urging Ed Barton to stay on top of this and asking him, is there any way that we can negotiate and not go into the auction process? He did investigate and found that the auction was slated to be on a certain day, and a couple of days before that, there was an opportunity to discuss the matter with the people that were responsible for the sale of this. So I urged him to discuss it and try to negotiate the sale right then, which he did. And apparently the price that we offered was somewhat higher than the price that Phillips had in mind, that they decided to close right away rather than wait for an auction. So we really got this. We may not have gotten it if it had go to the auction, but of course we'll never know. At any rate, it turned out to be just what I thought it was. First of all, it already had production that was that yielded income right away, and the there was very large areas yet to be explored, on which geophysical indications were very favorable. And my own feeling was that perhaps they had discovered only half the oil, half the gas that they would discover eventually, and there were oil possibilities as well. And Ed Barton was a little more conservative than I, and probably more right than I am, because he's the professional in this. At any rate, that was one of the reasons why I thought that it was imperative for us to try to get this and this very attractive area. He admitted, and we all agreed, that this would be a very long-term venture. It's probably the reserve would be something that would last, may last as long as 30 or more years. Furthermore, the additional advantage and attraction to this was that Holland had discovered and owned, as government owned, a very large gas field in Holland, which, however, they managed in such a way as not to hamper the efforts of this exploration and production of the offshore, which was done by private companies, because they wanted the maximum development of this. They didn't want to choke it off by producing all that the market could bear from their existing fields. So what they did, in effect, as the production mounted in offshore, they would reduce their production onshore, which made sense to them because it gave them, they conserved that that asset for many years to come. So as a result of that, they were able to in effect assure the venturers in the Dutch North Sea that there would never be a surplus of gas produced, and also to give them incentive to explore more. And as a matter of fact, the price is set by the government, and the price that we were receiving at that time, at the time of acquisition, was something like close to $4 per 1,000 cubic feet. Was raised as a result of within the first year to something like 4.5. Lately, because of collapse of the oil prices, and the gas prices were tied to the oil prices, this gas price had dropped down to about $2.50 per 1,000, but still a very, very generous price and very profitable price for these fields.
Where these is are the gas sold all over Europe? Where is the gas sold?
Mostly in Europe, in Germany, mostly in Germany and Belgium and France, so on. So it's distributed fairly widely in Europe.
You don't have to get into the sales or distribution?
No. No, this is just production. We did have to provide money for the pipeline to transport the gas from offshore into the pipeline system onshore, which was an additional capital expenditure. But it's one, I think it's one of the best things that Newmont Oil Company has ever done, actually. It's going to be exceedingly profitable. I regret to say that present management is contemplating selling all the oil assets in order to pay off the debts. What we actually acquired was seven blocks in Dutch North Sea, and the then measured reserves were 150 billion cubic feet of natural gas and 1.6 million barrels of reserve oil. And shortly after we made the acquisition, they discovered a major oil field in one of the blocks, which has not yet been evaluated from standpoint of reserves, but is promised to be a major field. So there's no question that this is one of the finest acquisitions that Newmont Oil has made.
$165 million that you paid for it?
Well, we had cash enough by that time. Newmont became more and more prosperous, and in the mid-1980s and late in 86, we were flush with cash.
So you could move it from one company to another?
Well, we actually organized a special company, and because of tax reasons, European oil company that holds it as a subsidiary of Newmont Oil.
But can you take profits from Newmont Gold, for example, and move them over and buy things from Newmont Oil?
The actual financing of this became really quite complicated because of tax consequences. Actually, part of the money came from Australia. And the reason it came from Australia is because the Australian gold mines were quite profitable, and the cash flow was more than they can use. But to move them in the way of dividends to the United States would have incurred a tax. And rather than do that, we used that cash that Australian companies had an investment in an oil company.
Mm-hmm. Now those are the kinds of things that are decided by...
This was decided essentially by our financial vice president by the name of Ed Fontaine. And he used to actually work for Mobil Oil, and so his acquainted with all kinds of ways of financing things. He's a very good man, very talented. But it was a complicated deal, and I don't even remember the full details of it now. Although I think maybe it's recorded, and I could, if you think that's of interest, I can...
Well, I was just sort of curious. Yeah, really. I can these kinds of things put it together. Are they in annual reports or something? I don't know how detailed those things.
Yeah, well, I have the details of the deal and so on, so I can get it.
Might be
of interest. Well, let's see.
When an oil field is drilled, my understanding that if I drill oil over here and somebody else is drilling in the same field, aren't you both tapping the same pool of oil?
Yeah, there's special provision for sharing that oil in a fair way so that one owner doesn't drain the others.
Are those provisions in the Dutch Sea similar to the ones they have?
Yes, they're recognized worldwide. I'd like to speak of another foreign venture that we made in 1968. Essentially, as a result of my close acquaintance with the Anglo-American group of South Africa, Harry Oppenheimer and some of his associates.
How had you become so closely acquainted with them?
And this is the acquisition of interest in Higveld, H-I-G-H-V-E-L-D, Steel and Vanadium Corporation Limited.
How had you become acquainted with Oppenheimer?
I covered that in my recent...
The one I just got?
Yeah.
All right, okay.
The initial contact was actually made by Frank McQuiston, our chief metallurgist at the time, who knew very well the chief metallurgist of Anglo-American by name of Ian Cairns, C-A-I-R-N-S. Ian Cairns had been involved in the investigation how to exploit a huge vanadium deposit that Anglo-America had discovered and developed in northern Transvaal. One of the problems with it is that it was actually an iron deposit with vanadium content, and it was difficult to recover vanadium from the iron ore, and he had the responsibility of trying to find the best method. Eventually, he developed a method of pyrometallurgical method of treating the iron ore in a certain way where the iron was recovered in furnaces and reverberatory furnaces, and the slag from these furnaces would contain the vanadium, and this involved really a novel process, a new process, and he therefore piloted it for some time, and Frank McQuiston heard about this. Anglo-American then decided to put it to commercial operation, and they had a financing scheme all set up, and were about to launch the enterprise when this came to my attention. I was particularly impressed by the size of the vanadium deposit, which was then and today is the largest vanadium deposit in the world, and probably the highest grade deposit also, even though the vanadium content was something less than 2% in the ore. Mm-hmm. And vanadium is a very valuable ferrous metal used in high-strength steels, and my conviction at that time and still is today that the future of these alloying elements that lend strength to the steel is very good, in that the general technology in the use of steel is moving into the high-strength steels. Even today in building skyscrapers, we don't use any longer the mild steel formed, you use high-strength steels, which are alloy steels containing vanadium, columbium, and molybdenum as alloying elements. And so it seemed to me vanadium had a had an excellent long time, long-term future, and this deposit would always be a valuable deposit. I recommended by Frank McQuiston, I
just made a second. Okay.
I became acquainted with Ian Cairns, and he explained the process, and I went over all their results and so on, and became convinced that the process as he had piloted was going to be a commercial process and was going to be a successful venture. So I began to investigate whether there's any possibility of Newmont investment in this, and at that time I made I became quite friendly with a financial one of these leading financial men of Anglo-American by name of Sidney Spiro, S-P-I-R-O. And when I talked to him about this and my interest in it, he says, "Oh, leave it up to me. Of course you can have a place in it. I'm sure that you will be welcomed. I think it'll be clear from the account that I've already made the association between Anglo-American and Newmont is a very long-standing." And so indeed he was right. That when it came to the to be known by Harry Oppenheimer that we were interested, he said, "Well, of course, Newmont can have a position in this." And we insisted that we should have at least a 10% interest, because this had a tax consequence. If you have 10% or more, your investment was treated in a different way, insofar as the U.S. taxes were concerned. Well, this presented something of a problem, but eventually they agreed, and we drew up a contract in which is a rather unusual contract, in which, in effect, we were guaranteed never to be diluted, to always have the opportunity of maintaining a 10% interest. True, if they sold more stock, we'd have to buy our share of the stock in order to get to maintain our interest. But what was most important to us, however, is that it's a habit of those South African companies very often to give large amounts of stock to directors and other people involved in this, where they were actually not selling stock. So we had to go into the open market in order to buy stock in order to maintain our 10%. But they were very meticulous and letting us know any of the schemes that they have, so we'd never drop to 10%. So we always had the chance, the right to maintain our percentage. So we bought actually 11.9% for $9.7 million and never put another penny into it. And this was, again, an unusual part of the deal, in that Anglo-American took on the responsibility for seeing this venture to the production stage, whatever it costs. And if it overran, why, they would furnish the money in a way of not equity money, but money that they would lend, so that it would not affect the equity owners, would not dilute them in effect. So really, we had a guarantee of of completion, in effect, without any requirement for further investment, which I considered to be very favorable. And indeed, the plant did overrun a good deal, and the Anglo-American had to put up very large sums of money. I don't recall exactly how much, but something approaching 100 million rand more to a venture that I think was originally estimated to require about 250 million rand. The whole venture is, aside from a big open pit mine, involved not only the primary recovery of iron and vanadium slag, but also the use of that iron in a steel mill. And they actually built and operated a steel mill, was the most modern continuous casting. The steel business of this was the most modern facility in South Africa, actually, although patterned after some of the more modern developments in Europe. While they had some technical difficulties for a while, yet since 1973, and this is shortly after they started operations, they have been consistently profitable.
Do you still have this?
Since 1973.
It's still part of Newmont?
Oh, yeah. No, this has been sold now by my successors, but but I have a record of our receiving our share of the dividends, and for our 9.7 million investment by 1985, we had received 17 million dollars in dividends. So it wasn't a bad venture. It was slow in coming because this is over a period of nearly 12 years, but still it's not a bad return on the investment up to that time. And it's going to continue for indefinitely. They have still probably 50 or 60 years of reserves ahead of them. It's an enormous, wonderful mine. Very well operated. I became quite friendly and well acquainted with the managers of this operation. The original chairman of the company was Harry Oppenheimer. He yielded his place to Graham Boustred, Boustred. And General Langton, former general in the South African Army, but technically competent, very good metallurgist, was the initial manager of the plant, has been since promoted and now is the director of Anglo-American and in charge of all their operations. Albert Robinson, Sir Albert Robinson, who was also a director of Anglo-American, was the chairman of this company initially. And replaced by Boustred, and more recently replaced by Leslie Boyd, a Scotchman, also a metallurgist and a steel man and steel expert and operator. I knew all, I became very friendly with all these people, especially Leslie Boyd, who's the last, managing director and now chairman. It's interesting that almost at the same time we were in, contemplating the investment in Foot, and that's a separate story that I'll tell. But the connection between Highveld and Foot was that part of the slag that Highveld produced and exported came to the United States, and Foot developed a process of recovering vanadium from slag, and they needed the raw material, and they made a long-term contract with Highveld to furnish slag. So there was a melding of two interests in there, and really, for a time, actually, a Anglo-American invested in Foot so that they would have a leg in the United States as well as in South Africa in the business of actually seeing the vanadium to in its final market, marketing posture.
Now, was this at the time that you already owned Foot?
Yes.
Did they ever own any part of Newmont? Or have a director or anything?
No.
No.
Never did, although personally, Harry Oppenheimer at one time owned, forget, I think about 200,000 shares of Newmont. Mm. That's a story in itself. It was in, I think it was in the 80s when Newmont began to grow like a mushroom and became very prosperous and sort of caught his attention, even though he knew about Newmont for many years. One time I was in South Africa, he told me that he had invested 200,000 in 200,000 shares personally, and he says, I think it'll be fun to be an a shareholder of Newmont after all these years.
200,000 shares for fun? How much was a share at that time?
Well, I don't recall right now, but I think it was probably in terms of the present present cost, it must well be around, I don't know, $15 a share or something. Anyway, he made a lot of money making that investment.
Just for fun.
I might skip now to a gold investment that we made in Australia, which turned out to be extremely profitable.
Telfer?
Gold investment in
Australia. Telfer,
maybe?
Is this Telfer?
Telfer, yes. Actually, our interest in Australia began back in about 1948, where we formed an exploration joint venture with Zinc Corporation, and which is an Australian company run by Robinson, forget his first name, anyway, a man of renowned stature and one of the important mining personalities in Australia, whom Fred Searles knew, and with whom I became acquainted later on. This exploration venture in the 40s was a modest one. We sent one geologist from here by the name of Platt C. Benedict, who was an excellent geologist, and on their side, the man who looked after the Zinc Corporation's interest was Morris Mawby, M-A-W-B-Y, later to become a sort of dean of Australian mining and the chairman of a company that the Zinc Corporation that was eventually merged with Rio Tinto. We identified a number of rather interesting ventures. Among them was a beach deposit of titanium and other hard heavy minerals on Stradbroke Island, Stradbroke. This was a huge deposit, and which could be dredged or otherwise recovered by mass mining methods, cheap methods. And one of the worries at that time on the part of Newmont board was whether or not the product that you would have would be marketable. And one of the directors knew Foot Mineral Company, which had some knowledge of these metals and asked their opinion of the marketability. This was my first acquaintance, actually, with Foot way back then. And their report on marketability of titanium was so-so. And Fred Searles chose to drop that interest. Later on, CRA, which was the merged company of Rio Tinto and Zinc Corporation, took it on as one of the more successful ventures in Australia. It's one of the big producers there. The other prospect that we identified and seemed worth looking into was Cobar, C-O-B-A-R, copper prospect, and there was some old mining going on and that, and was temporarily suspended, but geologically it appeared that there were further possibilities of increasing the reserves. Drilling program indeed confirmed this, and it looked as though it might be worthwhile trying to develop this, further develop this and put it into production. But again, Fred Searles ruled against it. This was all back in the 1940s. And so we retired from South Australian exploration without really any positive result. The reason I know about this in detail is because I was charged with the responsibility in New York to keep track of everything that was being done. So the reports came to me, and I made summary of these reports for both Phil Kraft and for Fred Searles, so they didn't have to read the long reports. All they did is read my summaries of it. That's summary books still exists in the files of Newmont, and is often consulted when we resumed that exploration effort much later, when I sent Bob Searles, or the son of Fred Searles, to Australia to be in charge of the exploration effort there.
And he eventually became a Canadian, an Australian.
Australian citizen, that's right. He moved his family there, and they're all live there now. Well, that's the early history of Newmont's involvement in Australia. But when it was resumed.
Excuse me, was Fred Searles just opposed to doing a lot of foreign things, or was it just on merit that he?
Well, he was very hesitant in going into new ventures, especially those that he hadn't examined himself, for one thing, and those that promised to require a lot of money, because he was very frugal in his investment. Prior to my accession as the president, I don't think he invested in anything that was in excess of $5 or $6 million. And I broke that sort of magic number almost right away. And we went to much larger investments. So anything that smelled of a large requirement for money, he was hesitant to initiate it. Back in the late 60s, as a result of some rather promising new developments in Australia, we decided we had better mount an exploration effort in Australia ourselves. And I sent Bob Searles down there, and he organized a group, essentially of geologists, for an exploration effort. We were looking for all kinds of things at that time. Among them was an interest also in gold. At one point, sometime in the early 70s, probably 71 or 72, he sent a report on an area in Western Australia, in the Great Western Desert, rather remote area, in which there were very interesting gold values scattered over a large area, and the geological analysis did not define what where this came from, or whether there was any continuity in this. The results were rather erratic, some high grade, some very low grade areas. And I remember that Bob Searles either called me or perhaps wrote me to say that, they've been trying to appraise this, can't make any sense of it, and I think that maybe we should drop this. They had already spent a fair amount of money on this prospect.
Now, at this time, had you organized a subsidiary there, or was he working?
No, he was working out of Melbourne. The headquarters were in Melbourne.
But you had an Australian subsidiary.
Yeah, this was an Australian subsidiary that he organized.
I see.
I communicated with Bob, and I said, look, it seems to me that from the number of gold samples, and some of them quite good grade, and the extension of them, there must be something of significance somewhere in this. I think you'd better send your best geologist over there and and try to figure that out. So he did not dispose of it, and he proceeded to do just what I suggested. And sure enough, within 6 or 8 months, they finally discovered the cause of this and where it came from, and began to define the gold-bearing strata. Which was developed into the Telfer mine. In 1973, the preliminary drilling indicated some 2,200,000 tons of ore assaying 0.42 ounces per ton, which was quite great, nearly half an ounce of gold per ton. And this would be obviously close enough to the surface to mine by open pit. Furthermore, metallurgical studies indicated that it would be easily recoverable with high recovery in the high 90s. So further drilling finally developed a total reserve of 4,200,000 tons of 0.28 ounces per ton mineable by open pit. We began to make plans for exploitation of this deposit. But one of the problems created by the Australian government was that they had recently legislated or brought in a law whereby foreign companies could not own more than 49% of anything in Australia. However, the final judgment of Australian investment was left to the provincial heads and the head of the Western Australia province was at that time. I think it's Albert Cort, C-O-R-T. First name may be wrong, I'll get the right name. At any rate, Bob Searles knew him somewhat and went to him with this problem and said that, look, we discovered this, and this is an unusually attractive venture, and we hate to give away 51%. Could you not tolerate our finding of an Australian investor that would take less than 50%? After some palavers and several discussions, finally, Court agreed to this, and we went to Broken Hill Proprietary, a company which Bob Searles knew and which is the biggest mining company in Australia, and offered them 30% participation. Interestingly enough, despite the fact that this was just a minor speck in their total investment position in Australia, they became interested in diversifying into gold and took this percentage. And they've been very happy with that investment ever since. By 1975, we had finally decided to go ahead with a 1,350 ton per day mill, which was initially estimated at something like $37 or $38 million. I took exception to this and felt that it was too high a figure. The return at the $35 gold at that time was not going to be very attractive. And talked to our chief engineer, who was by that time Peter Crescenzo. Telling him that can't you figure out some way of reducing the cost, and because this figure is too high, and we will go ahead with it if you can reduce it into the 20s. Well, he managed to do this and that and the other, and finally came up with an estimate. It was 22 million only. And I then authorized for him us to go ahead on this. Actually, we did spend 27 million, but we enlarged the scope to some extent. So it was quite an acceptable figure. But this 27 million included not only the development of the mine, which was out nowhere at all, the development of water, the development of power, development of access, a road that had to be a 250-mile road to get to this place, and an airport, and a town site, with schools for the town site, all kinds of things, amenities for the town, because this was so remote that we were afraid that we couldn't keep any people living there.
What was the town that was 250 miles away?
250 miles away from the nearest town, tiny
town?
Little town.
Kalgoorlie? Was this anywhere out near Kalgoorlie?
It's, I forget these names right now, but...
But it was Western Australia.
Yes, it's in Western Australia. It's about 350 miles from the famous Mount Newman mines.
Oh, yeah.
This is farther north. And this is just a little village, actually, the 240 miles. At any rate, access was extremely difficult.
But you did succeed in getting people there.
Well, the first problem we had in the construction of this, of the mill and preparation for it for production, the people that we hired to do this all of a sudden struck, they had a labor strike. And labor strikes in Australia then and now are very difficult to handle. And this is a very militant group. And the general opinion at that time was that we'd have to yield to their demands, and they wanted a much higher wages and so on. Bob Searles, on his initiative and with my approval, said, we're going to fight these people. We're not going to allow them to run us. And strangely enough, maybe partly because of remoteness of the area, we won the strike. We won the contest. And the people went back to work, and we lost very few workmen, and we proceeded to complete the job. And part of the increase from 22 to 27 million is because of the increased cost of the strike, and then somewhat increased wages that we had to pay.